EU finance ministers have concluded 2 days of talks relating to the 27 country bloc's dire economic situation resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic.
It has been a particular challenge for young women and men, but also those who are employed in contact-intensive parts of our economies.
One such person is Simon Ledoux, who worked in the hospitality industry in Brussels. He feels abandoned by the state since losing his job.
I feel very depressed. I'm looking for a job, but I didn't find. And my friends, like me, didn't find job.
The social crisis in the EU continues to deepen. Richer member states are being urged to support poorer ones. Within the EU, social rights campaigners say solidarity is now needed like never before in the bloc's history, because of huge disparities among member states in terms of their ability to cope and recover. The European Commission warns a record number of businesses will go under when governments start easing financial aid programmes. The Commission claims firms that were not viable prior to the crisis will be impacted most. Only six EU nations have so far submitted draft plans to draw down money from a 750 billion euro coronavirus recovery fund.
I call on the remaining countries to ratify the own resources decision quickly so that the Commission can start its borrowing program under the Next Generation EU.
Illegal US sanctions against Iran preventing EU businesses from trading with the Islamic Republic show how the dollar is too dominant over the euro. Eurozone finance ministers have been encouraged to strengthen the currency's position on the international stage.
Recent episodes where the dollar was used as a policy tool reminded us that this is not good from a European perspective.
Economists warn the biggest threat to the Eurozone economy right now is the EU's dysfunctional COVID-19 vaccination strategy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of discussion and some rough debates, members of the French Parliament have voted a new law, officially called the Law on Principles of the Republic. French authorities say they want to strengthen the respect of equality, fraternity and liberty, but the opposition denounces, as it was called first, the Law on Separatism. They sound the alarm on the stigmatization of the Muslim community.
More and more children do not go to the same schools because of the social origin of their parents. That's school separatism. Without saying it, this law concerns only our fellow Muslim citizens and creates a debate on identity rather than on social problems. During weeks, this debate has been a festival of discrimination towards Muslims.
French Interior Minister Darmanin already said that mosques will be closely monitored. Law experts say that this text can be interpreted in different ways, which could lead to arbitrary decisions like the closure of watchdog associations defending the rights of Muslims. Opposition members in the parliament blame the government for not being concerned about the real social problems of the population.
Yes, there is a separatism in this country, a separatism in school and on the French territory. This bill does not speak about it. Our children, depending on which school they go to, do not have the same chances. The public school is weakened.
The opposition group in the French parliament also criticizes the actual French government for seducing far-right voters, as the new French president will be elected in only a year. What is more important, security issues or social welfare?
We had 2 years of social agitation with a yellow vest movement and a movement against the retirement law. The poverty and social inequality are exploding in France. But no, they debate on the headscarf.
The reaction of the Muslim community is taking form, but slowly and in a dispersed order. Hundreds demonstrated in Paris, and hundreds of religious leaders and human rights associations asked members of parliament in a public letter not to vote this law on separatism. The law has been adopted by a majority in the French parliament, but Muslims and human rights defenders already promised to continue the protest. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Turkish president vowed that the cross-border military operations that Turkish military is conducting against PKK will continue, as he confirmed Ankara's willingness to expand areas of operations from which threats against Turkey are coming, assuring that the death of 13 Turkish citizens who lost their lives in the Gara attack will strengthen the government's determination to eliminate terrorist groups.
Northern Iraq's Gara province has now been made secure as a result of a four-day military operation. We will stay in the areas that we have made safe in a bid to avoid similar attacks. Gara was a troubled region. It is taken now, and the problem is gone.
Turkish Defense Minister, along with Interior Minister, met with opposition figures Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu and Meral Akşener separately and explained in details the military operation that was conducted in the region. The two ministers also briefed the parliament on the circumstances of the operation and the martyrdom of 13 Turkish citizens on the hands of PKK. Analysts say the meetings and parliament session were in preparation to draft a resolution to grant the Turkish army the permission to hold wide-range cross-border operation in Sinjar and other areas in northern Iraq.
The war between Turkey and the PKK has been going on for decades. However, I think this time a decision is being made to eliminate the group's terrorists wherever they are. The operation will include Sinjar and Kandil areas. I think all political parties will agree on launching a wider cross-border operation despite knowing that such a decision will be met with opposition from European countries and, of course, Turkey's NATO ally, the United States.
Turkey accused the U.S. of siding with terrorists. Turkish president said the U.S. statement concerning the death of 13 Turkish citizens is considered, quote, a joke. Other Turkish politicians and political parties also condemned it, saying the U.S. exposed its cooperation with PKK in such a statement. It seems that, unlike Turkish expectations, the new U.S. administration, like its predecessors, will continue to support the Kurdish groups. Many expect the two NATO allies go into another round of tensions. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
February 2011. Emboldened by what was then hailed as the Arab Spring, people took to the streets in Bahrain. The crackdown that followed was brutal. Hospitals overflowed with the dead and injured, and the prisons filled up. On the 10th anniversary of the pro-democracy movement, the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights held a conference. According to the speakers, the situation in Bahrain is worse now than before 2011, with hundreds of journalists, human rights defenders, and opposition figures still behind bars. The US and the UK have military bases in Bahrain. Human rights organizations say both are complicit in the monarchy's rights abuses by refusing to exert the influence they obviously have over the monarchy.
Bahrain is a political ally of the West. It's not some other, you know, this country that there is no kind of form of leverage or control over. In fact, the strength of US and British leverage on the regimes is so strong that it actually, I would say, coerce some of these regimes into entering the normalization deal with Israel that was perceived by, you know, across the board in Bahrain, you know, pro and anti-government people as the final act of betrayal.
One aspect of Bahrain's repressive tactics has received international attention: torture and sexual abuse used in prisons. And the UK's complicity is irrefutable. It trained Bahrain's police force, which carries out the torture, and the Special Investigations Unit, which continues to fail the victims. Some are on death row after giving false confessions under duress, and others live on with the horror playing before their eyes every day. We spoke to one of the victims.
It wasn't a prison, it was a morgue. You had no right to say you were innocent. If you did, they would start the torture, psychological torture. They would give us hallucination drugs. None of the guards were Bahraini. And they weren't normal. They were sick. They would make fun of us for missing our kids and family. Those who had kids were tortured the most. They weren't allowed to have visitors if they so much as drank water without permission. I think of those women. God help them.
Britain's top military brass were in Bahrain 5 days before the 2011 crackdown, in which 1,000 Saudi troops trained and equipped by the UK backed Bahrain's security forces. And since then, Britain has given Bahrain £6.5 million worth of technical assistance. Pressure is growing on Westminster to end the collusion. But Downing Street's damning record proves strategic interests trump human rights concerns every time. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in the Israeli military jail of Aufer started a partial strike by refusing to take their meals in protest against the escalated successive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, for almost 2 weeks, prisoners in Aufer jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, including surprise night raids and intensive unannounced cell search, strip searches, and being sprayed with poisonous gases, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
A big number of administrative detainees are held in Aufer. What's going on there amounts to a crime being planned by the prison's officials. They want to bring the prisoners of Aufer to their knees. They have escalated their aggressive measures, such as carrying out several surprise searches of cells day and night.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held in Aufer jail, including minors. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the inmates have sent a clear message to the prison administration that if these invasions and assaults that are against international laws and the Geneva Convention do not come to an end, then the prisoners will escalate their protest measures within the coming days.
Prisoners' lives are in danger because they don't intend to remain silent against this brutality. Prisoners now are planning other measures to protest their conditions, including refusal to talk with prison administrators and starting an open-ended hunger strike.
Reports say over 4,500 Palestinians are currently languishing in a number of Israeli jails, including hundreds being held without charge or trial under the illegal imprisonment known as administrative detention. Palestinian prisoners have always endured grievous oppression in Israeli jails. However, people in the occupied territories are worried today about their loved ones. They are concerned not only about recent brutal measures taken in the Israeli jail of Aufer, but also about the reports that more inmates there and in other jails have been tested positive for the coronavirus. Muna Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
In the limelight.
It is indeed unfortunate of the UN to have wasted time and energy on a clearly pro-invader stance by refusing to condemn the Riyadh Abu Dhabi deal for imposing an unwarranted war on the people of Yemen that has led to the death of over 200,000 men, women, and children, in addition to the destruction of the environment. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading U.S. and UN Meddling Preventing Peace in Yemen. Stay tuned for the details, please. Prospects of peace are beginning to prevail in Yemen and could lead to end of the six-year-long Saudi-UAE invasion of the most impoverished Arab state, provided the U.S. and the UN cease meddling in the strategic developments underway in centrally located Ma'rib. The legitimate Sana'a-based government of Yemen, led by the popular Ansarullah movement, seems all poised to liberate Ma'rib and the surrounding oil-rich areas from control of the mercenaries of the fugitive from justice, Mansour Hadi, who lives under Saudi protection in Riyadh and shamelessly calls himself president. The Saudis and the Emirates, along with their masters in Washington, London, and Paris, as well as the Zionists, fear that the liberation of Ma'rib will make the southern tribes tired of being used as a pawns by foreign powers in control of the port city of Aden, make peace with legal government in Sana'a. It is indeed unfortunate of the UN to have wasted time and energy on a clearly pro-invader stance by refusing to condemn the Riyadh's Abu Dhabi DU for imposing an unwarranted war on the people of Yemen that has led to the death of over 200,000 men, women and children, in addition to the destruction of the environment. If the world body had been loyal to its own charter regarding invasion of a sovereign member state, instead of calling as rebels the defenders of their aggressed homeland, the conflict would have long ended, and there might have been a national coalition government in Yemen, representing the various tribes, political parties, and religious groups. It didn't under US pressure, and the result is the impending famine, which could still be averted only with the liberation of the Maghreb by the government forces. This means Mark Lowcock, the UN Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, is wide off the mark with his tweet that the fall of Maghreb to the Ansarullah would endanger 2 million civilians and could cause hundreds of thousands to flee the city with unimaginable humanitarian consequences. He is only parroting what Washington says in a bid to save the skins of the Saudi criminals whose military-industrial installations are facing a steady barrage of ballistic missiles and drones, and not out of any sympathy for the people of Yemen. No, Mr. Lowcock, you are as mistaken as your special envoy for Yemen, Britain's Martin Griffiths, who has never been neutral in his so-called peace mission and whose sole purpose has been either to install a puppet pro-Western regime or split Yemen into the north and south. The authorities in Sana'a are patriots in the real sense of the term, dedicated to the unification of the homeland without foreign interference and through peaceful means that requires decisive operations against mercenaries in order to provide relief to the civilian population and ensure their welfare. It is better for the UN to tell the US to stop poking its nose in the Yemen conflict, whether by designating the Ansarullah movement as terrorists, as the criminal Donald Trump had done, or to remove that label, as Joe Biden recently did, not out of concern for humanitarian values, but to deceive the people of Yemen and hold them hostages to American hegemony. So just stay out of the current conflict and let the people of Yemen decide their fate through inter-Yemeni negotiations, joint operations against mercenaries, and the right to retaliate against the unpardonable crimes of the Saudis. And a piece of advice to the new administration in Washington. Don't try to act as if you had done a favor to the Yemenis, since the terrorist attack has no significance for them and the resolve to make their country independent of foreign influence.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm Andrew. The only proper way to resolve the deadlock over the Iran nuclear deal is Washington's return to it. That's what China believes is the solution to the deadlock. Russia has already shared an identical viewpoint. Tehran insists it was Washington that abandoned the JCPOA in 2018, so that's the party to take the first step, if it ever wishes to go back, as claimed by President Biden. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has asserted that the Islam Republic has had enough of lip service. Tehran is now awaiting action by Washington, which means the removal of all sanctions reimposed on the Islam Republic under the Trump administration.
The fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal still remains uncertain. The United States says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord. Tehran, however, argues that it was Washington that walked away from the international accord and hence it should first fulfill all its obligations, including the lifting of sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Now China has once again called on the U.S. to return to the deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, saying it is the only proper way to resolve the deadlock over the issue.
China always believes that the U.S. return to the JCPOA is the only way to resolve the deadlock in the Iran nuclear issue. All parties should feel the urgency to work together to implement the consensus reached during the Foreign Ministers Conference on the Iran nuclear issue in last December, and urge the U.S. side to return to the JCPOA unconditionally as soon as possible while lifting all sanctions against Iran.
Meanwhile, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said the new U.S. administration needs to act swiftly to make up for Washington's past mistakes and return to the rule of law. Rouhani stressed that the Iranian nation will never bow to U.S. bullying. On Wednesday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said what Tehran wants to see from the other parties to the nuclear deal is action, not words. The new U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled a willingness to rejoin the JCPOA, but his administration has conditioned the move on Tehran's resumption of its commitments. Tehran has repeatedly said it will accept no precondition for the return of the United States to the agreement. Iran recently announced that it has decided to suspend the snap inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Officials said the move would be in line with the Iranian parliament's recent legislation called the Strategic Action Plan to counter sanctions. Tehran, however, noted that the decision does not mean ending all IAEA inspections of its nuclear facilities. In reaction, the UN nuclear watchdog said its director, Rafael Mariano Grossi, will travel to Iran to discuss the issue. After the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories to the deal to make up for the U.S. pullout. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments, prompting Tehran to scale back on its commitments under the accord. However, Iran has time and again said that their measures are fully reversible upon full compliance by the remaining signatories. Now questions arise as to whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or try to rectify the Trump-era policy against Iran, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's closest allies.
Okay, that was a report by Mehdi Fireman. Let me invite our guest to this show. We'll have Executive Director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, Daniel McAdams, in Lake Jackson, Texas, and also author of The Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, Gareth Porter, who is joining us out of Arlington, Virginia. Good to have both of you on the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Daniel. China and Russia have echoed Iran's stance as to the U.S. return to the accord. What would you advise the Biden administration do, if you could? And let's not forget the fact that Iran is still under a so-called most severe sanctions that have been in place by the Trump administration, known as the maximum pressure campaign.
Well, President Biden's administration has had a full month now to revise Trump's failed policy. Maximum pressure has been a maximum failure. There has not been much action, and in fact, you know, I think they're sort of tied into a corner right now. You have some strong statements by Anthony Blinken, who talks about the need for Iran to return to the deal first, whereas, of course, as your report pointed out, as everyone knows, it was President Trump of the United States that pulled out of the deal. The net result of this whole thing really is the U.S. is losing stature as a good actor in the world stage. If you can't keep your deals, if you can't keep your bargains, then nobody will deal with you in the future. So this is a problem for the Biden administration. They don't seem to be moving in the right direction.
Gareth, on Wednesday, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei said that what Tehran wants from Washington is, I'm quoting him, action, not words, over the nuclear deal. And we have heard many nice words and promises, which in practice have been broken, and even opposite actions have been taken. Now, does Iran have good reasons to distrust the U.S. intentions and policies?
I think it's a fair statement to make that Iran does have good reason to distrust American statements about this entire issue. And really, one has to go back some years, if not decades, and understand the origins of this situation, which is that the U.S. government, going back not just to the Trump administration or even to the Obama administration, but previous to that, had a strategy of really trying to coerce Iran to bow down to U.S. demands with regard to its nuclear program. And this was, in fact, a fundamental sort of principle of operation of the U.S. in international affairs during and after the Cold War, which was to establish a hierarchy of power, a clear hierarchy in which the United States would be calling the shots, and smaller, weaker states would have to buckle under to the U.S. diktat. And so I think what we've seen in recent years is a continuation of that situation, where the United States expected that it could somehow continue to impose its will on Iran. And the JCPOA was certainly to a great extent a departure from that, because at the beginning, let's face it, the United States believed that it had the wherewithal to force Iran to essentially give up its nuclear program, to have no enrichment. That was the demand that President Obama was making as late as 2012. And when the negotiations began, he soon began to realize that he wasn't going to be able to enforce that. And so the process of making concessions to Iran and its rights began. And I think the final result bears that out, without going into more detail. But I think we have to recognize that the Biden administration now is continuing this practice, this belief, if you will, that the United States can and must impose its will on Iran by pressure, by having leverage on Iran. Mm-hmm. And that means that it must somehow rely on the Trump administration's sanctions against mm-hmm. Iran, which are the strongest sanctions the United States has ever brought to bear against Iran. And that is why I think it's clear the Trump administration is not ready to go back to the JCPOA at this point and wants to continue to try to exercise that leverage.
Right. Now, Daniel, the Biden administration's public stance is that it will only lift sanctions on Iran if the country reduces the activity of its civilian program to the JCPOA limits. But it was the U.S. that violated the agreement, and Tehran wants Washington to act first. U.S. took the first step out. Now it should take the first step in. Now, is Iran asking for too much?
Well, I think they're both publicly making strong stances and seemingly intractable, but I think we've seen some indications. There have been kind of a flurry of diplomacy. There have been the involvement of third-party actors this past week. Merkel spoke to Rouhani, I think it was yesterday, and there have been a couple of similar conversations. Remember, we are on the cusp of the Munich International Security Conference, where President Biden is supposed to speak tomorrow, scheduled to speak tomorrow. So if he, in fact, remembers where he is when he's speaking or what he's talking about, there is some possibility that he might make mention of the JCPOA in some way. But in your report, you quoted Khamenei as talking about what we need to see action. But he also said, if we see action from the other side, we will take action as well. So I think there's an indication of some ability to move. People have talked about some kind of a phased return to the JCPOA with the EU as kind of a broker. So I think there are more possibilities, there are more things on the table than it may seem when you simply listen to the rhetoric of both sides.
Now, Gareth, the issue of distrust is a very serious one as far as Iran is concerned, and you know very well about Iran. You have written books about it. And the U.S. signed this multilateral UN-backed deal with Iran and then simply left it after a short while. Then it even threatened the remaining signatories not to stick to their commitments as per the deal. So how can Iran trust the same wouldn't happen again?
Well, I think Iran must trust the United States to be the United States. I think that's the problem, that it must have a realistic appraisal of the way the United States operates and an understanding of the psychological and political origins of the strategies and tactics that the United States practices diplomatically in regard to smaller states, states that do not have the same degree of power that the United States has. And at one time, as you know very well, and as your viewers know very well, the United States relied on the threat of military force as its primary source of leverage or pressure against Iran. And now it's very clear the United States recognizes that is not going to work. It is no longer possible to rely on the threat of war against Iran because Iran has too much power to resist and to essentially impose real serious costs on the United States and its allies in the region. So now they are relying entirely on their economic sanctions, and specifically the ability to deny Iran the ability to trade, to sell its oil, which is the mainstay of its national budget. And so I think it's much more fundamental here. I'm not nearly as optimistic as I think Dan has suggested he is at this point, that there is a lot of room here for negotiation. I think there's going to have to be a much more fundamental shift in the nature of thinking about Iran on the part of the Biden administration in order to get somewhere in the zone of real negotiation. And I must say that the people who have now moved into the primary positions of policymaking in the Biden administration are not people who've impressed me as really very flexible in their thinking. So I'm relatively pessimistic at this point about an early resolution or even a beginning of resolution of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, before taking office, President Biden pledged to work with Iran to restore the JCPOA, but so far his administration has failed to act. What do you think is the reason for this failure?
Well, Biden ran as the anti-Trump, and now certainly on foreign policy. But now that he's in office, he is basically, continuing the worst of Trump's policies, and in terms of continued sanctions against Venezuela, continued dedication to regime change in Syria, whereas I think Trump lost a little bit of stomach for these Middle East adventures, even with, a few of his infractions. But he is continuing this idea of a sanctions regime, and I think Gareth is right. And by the way, I'm just trying to sound optimistic. I'm not that optimistic. But I think, as Gareth said, there are so many people that have gone into the administration who spent these last 4 years in very provocative positions with regard to Syria, with regard to regime change, with regard to Iran, that it does make you wonder. So many people from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy have gone into the administration and other various AIPAC-oriented think tanks that you can't really be too optimistic, even as I try to be. But, trying to read the tea leaves as to what might be happening, you do notice some sort of neocon chatter. And, I mean, I hate to sort of rely on this, but they're even dragging out old Reza Pahlavi. You know, once again, they're dusting him off to warn, don't you dare go back into the JCPOA. Biden, it's so dangerous, and this sort of thing. So you're seeing neocons, you're seeing a lot of U.S. representatives, and of course the war and war threatening is the lifeblood of Washington. But they're coming out and threatening Biden. And I'm just wondering, are they nervous and how nervous are they? And that might that be an indication that Biden is about to perhaps take some moves in the positive direction?
Now let me ask Gareth for some more explanation on the point that he's not so optimistic regarding what President Biden promised during the electoral campaign. So is it only the people around him, Gareth, or what?
Well, I think it's primarily the people that he's named to be Secretary of State and National Security Advisor who are people who are really hardliners on issues that relate to this problem. And I feel that they are not inclined in any near-term view to be flexible. They're not simply sort of voicing threats that they're hoping Iran will now suddenly respond to with their own sort of making concessions so that they can then shift into a different mode. I feel like that they're taking a stand that is more fundamental here. And it's extremely dangerous. Let's be clear about this. I think it is dangerous. But it does reflect a set of expectations, a set of values, and on the other side of the picture, or part of this picture, is the domestic political structure of the United States, which is so strongly dominated by right-wing extremist views on Iran. And I think Biden himself and his advisors, his key national security officials, are very sensitive to that domestic political context as well. So it's an additional factor that leads me to feel relatively pessimistic about short-term sort of progress in the direction of diplomatic resolution.
Okay. Now, Daniel, let's take a look at the EU in the middle of all of this and the European signatories to the nuclear deal. They have always insisted the deal must be preserved, but in action they have failed to fulfill their commitments under that accord. They have been accusing even Iran of not sticking to it. And how do you see the European side of the deal's behavior and role?
Well, the Europeans have made a decision to de facto pull out of the deal themselves after the U.S. did and after people like John Bolton exerted pressure on them to do so. They haven't shown a lot of backbone or a lot of spine when it comes to this, but that really shouldn't be shocking because we're talking about the EU here, especially EU foreign policy, which tends to be Washington's lapdog. But I don't think that doesn't mean that they have a role to play here. I don't think that they wanted the deal to go sour, unlike President Trump did. I think they want to be in the deal. Certainly the Germans had experienced the positive effects of the deal with the renewal of trade relations with Iran and a lot of money changing hands. So I think they want it to go forward. I think they have a role to play. I think they can play a role of some sort of slow walking back the sanctions. And but I think at the end of the day, the Iranians are holding a lot more cards than Washington right now, even though, of course, there's a disparity in military power. The Iranians have announced that they are, February 23rd, going to pull out of the voluntary additional protocols, which allows snap inspections from the IAEA. They have so many moves that they can make and continue to make with, I think, a pretty good guess that Washington is not about to go to war as they do these things. There are several more moves they can make. There really aren't a lot of more moves that Washington can make at this point. So I think the Iranians are actually in pretty good position vis-a-vis Washington on this.
Okay. Now, Gareth, Daniel talked about the EU's role in this. Now, what about the role of Israel in this process?
The Israelis are playing the same role that they have in the past, or at least attempting to play that role, of putting pressure on the White House to hew to essentially Israeli interests by essentially not going ahead with any serious negotiations that would result in making concessions to Iran on their nuclear program. That hasn't changed at all. If anything, the Israeli government has hardened its posture in recent days, and we see the prime minister essentially naming somebody to deal with the United States and other countries on this issue who knows nothing about it and who is simply going to be following Netanyahu's own orders almost day by day. But I don't think that Israel has the same degree of clout that it did, you know, some years ago. I think it's been shown that they cannot control U.S. policy, that U.S. Policy toward Iran is effectively driven by domestic U.S. interests or interests that whatever administration in power has in regard to the issue. Now, that was not particularly true of the Trump administration, where you had special, you obviously had special relationship between Trump and the Israelis, which had a monetary character because of his reliance on pro-Israeli financiers to, mm-hmm. to fund his election campaigns. But I think now we have a situation where Israel does not have the kind of clout that it had under Trump, and even less than it had, I think, during the Obama administration.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Thanking my guests in this debate, we had Executive Director of the Iran Policy for Peace and Prosperity, Daniel McAdams from Lake Jackson, Texas, and author of The Manufacturer Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, Gareth Porter from Arlington, Virginia.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Afghans and human rights advocates around the world express deep disappointment after the European Court of Human Rights ruled in favor of Germany in a case brought by victims of a 2009 NATO airstrike that killed as many as 90 civilians. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Is Our Blood Worth Less? Afghan Anguish After European Court Sides with Germany Over Airstrike That Killed 90 Civilians. Here's the detail. Afghans and human rights advocates around the world expressed deep disappointments recently after the European Court of Human Rights ruled in favor of Germany in a case brought by victims of a 2009 NATO airstrike that killed as many as 90 civilians. The New York Times reports a 17-judge panel of the ECHR ruled unanimously that the German government adequately investigated a September 3, 2009 airstrike in Afghanistan, Kunduz province that targeted two fuel tankers stolen by Taliban militants. Believing the militants might use the trucks as a mobile bomb, Colonel George Klein, the German commanding officer of a nearby NATO base, ordered U.S. warplanes to destroy the vehicles. According to German broadcaster Deutsche Welle, prosecutors said Klein made several calls to an informant to ensure there were no civilians present before the strike. However, scores of Afghan civilians, including children, flocked to the trucks, which were stuck on a sandbank in Kunduz River to siphon off fuel at the Taliban's invitation. A German military investigation later found that as many as 90 civilians died in the massive explosion caused by the strike. The probe concluded that no charges should be brought against Klein. The recent ECHR ruling stated that Klein had not incurred criminal liability mainly because he had been convicted at the time of ordering the airstrike, that no civilians had been present at the sandbank. Klein was promoted to general in 2012. The court also found there was no violation of Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights, that it had no reason to doubt Germany's assertion that it thoroughly investigated the airstrike as required under the Charter, and that Klein had not acted with the intent to cause excessive civilian casualties. The court's findings gave no comfort to plaintiff Abdul Hanan, a farmer whose sons Abdul Bayan and Nasrullah, ages 12 and 8, respectively, were killed in the strike. "They martyred 100 people. They bombed us unjustly. So how can they come to this unjust decision?" Hanan told the Times after the ECHR ruling. "Is our blood worth less than the blood of a German? I wanted the court to provide justice, to have mercy on us," Hanan added. In the aftermath of the mass killing, Germany offered $5,000 payments to families of civilians who died or were seriously injured in the strike. Hanan sought additional damages as well as an admission by German officials that they failed to protect civilians. The German government claimed it was not legally responsible for the deaths since the airstrike was executed on behalf of the United Nations. Last December, Germany's Constitutional Court ruled that the country was not liable for the civilian casualties. According to the Costs of War project at Brown University's Watson Institute, more than 43,000 Afghan civilians have been killed during the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan, now in its 20th year. Taliban militants have killed the most non-combatants, but thousands of men, women, and children have also been killed by the U.S. regime bombs and bullets.
Thank you. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.